It's not just his parsha. Let me first fully explain Jakey's question before we answer the question. Rav Dovi, because not everybody knows about it, would you mind if you're schmoozing with Sammy anyway, which I'd like to do? I'm jealous. Both walk downstairs just so people know in Beit Midrash, etc., we're having a question and answer session. And keep talking. I'm just saying, you know, would you mind? You wouldn't be, thank you very much. If you walk with Sammy, everyone will come running over because they'll see Sammy and then you'll tell them. Okay. Jakey Taber's question is this. If you look in Torah Shebichtav, how many times does it mention Olam Haba? On the other hand, it talks many times about getting Sachar, and it always talks about this world. There are psukim that are much clearer than Yaman, Yericho, and Yamecha. There are psukim that write beferish about the Tochor, and the Brachor, and Kriyat Shema, etc. The problem with that is, it doesn't happen. If you look around the world, a lot of only the good die young, right? Not so Pasha.
Baruch Yol.
Sefer Yit, Baruch Yol, yeah, exactly. It's not such a... I know other people too, other philosophers. I'm just saying that happens to be his line. Only the good die young. So, you know, in Chazal's time, people suffered too. And there are famous stories, you know, Gemara and Kiddush and Daf Mem and Acher and people going climbing a tree at their parents' behest to do Shiloh HaKein. And so the Gemara, they're famously Darshins that the Pesukim are talking about Olam Haba. So one question is, if Olam Haba is true, why does the Torah not mention it? Number two, the Torah mentions Olam Hazeh. Right? You know what I'm saying? This is your question, right, in the bigger picture. First, how do we know there's Olam Haba? In fact, even more than that, it's one of the Yud Gimel Ikar. It's one of the 13 principles of faith. Believing in Yetzias Mitzrayim is not one of the 13 principles of faith. I mean, it's very important, but it's not one of the 13 principles. Har Sinai, not one of the 13 principles of faith. Olam Haba, one of the 13 principles of faith. So if it's a principle of faith, why is it mentioned in the Torah? And if it's not mentioned in the Torah, how do we know that it's a principle of faith? It's getting deeper, right? It's getting worse before it gets better. So first let's start. How do we know there's Olam Haba? Ariel told us. If Ariel told us, we believe. Yaakov, you agree?
Yeah.
If Yaakov agrees, we have two Edom. We believe. Right? Grandma got run over by a reindeer, right? We believe. You want another song? Okay, anyway. How do we know it's Olam Haba? The answer is very simple. If you don't believe in Olam Haba, you don't believe that God is a fair judge. Because in this world, people don't get their due. People don't get their due. For example, Akiva Tolchin. Who knows a better musician than Akiva Tolchin? Ariel Felsen's a better musician? I don't know. I like Ariel Felsen, but who? Who's better?
Bachman.
Where's Bachman? Oh, Bachman. Okay. Akiva Bachman. Who knows a better musician than Akiva Bachman? People that go to TABC know how to play music well. Okay, that's the conclusion. Now, my shaila is, you know, they have to work so hard to put their music on iTunes, they have to struggle. It's not fair. You know, if they would get what they deserve, it would already be right away a big gadol hador, and everyone would know who he was, and that was it. And the whole world would be listening to Akiva Bachman. Akiva Tolchin, anyone else named Akiva went to TABC, and that would be it, right? It doesn't work that way. Good people suffer. People don't deserve benefits. What's pshat? If you don't believe in Olam Haba, you don't believe in justice, period. If you believe in Schar V'Onesh, you believe in Olam Haba. So now the question becomes, okay, if Schar V'Onesh is in the next world, why does the Torah not talk about it? It should say, Schar V'Onesh, in the next world. I think the answer to that question is very, very important. The Torah is about this world. The Torah is not about the next world. The Torah doesn't talk about aliens, and the Torah doesn't talk about Mashiach, and the Torah doesn't talk about Olam Haba, and it doesn't talk about Tchias HaMesim, and it doesn't answer most of the questions people are interested in knowing about. The Torah, which means direction, is directions for how to live our lives properly in this world. The Torah is not going to tell you do things for the next world. It's going to tell you understand your world. Live the best way you can and should in your world. And that's why all the psukim in the Torah about Tchar V'Onesh are about this world. Another question becomes, but they're not true. You know what I'm saying? So again, we darshan about the next world on a deeper level, but the Torah talks about this world. And I think the answer to that question is also important. If you look at all the tochachos, if you look at the two parshiyos of Kriya Shema, for example, the second parsha of Kriya Shema is very similar to the first one, right? Beginning is similar, the end is similar, the second one is longer, right? What's added in the second one we don't have in the first one? Schar V'Onesh. There's also another difference between the second parsha and the first parsha. The first parsha is written in Lashon Yochid. Second parsha is written in Rabim. V'ahavto, that's Hashem Elokecha. V'ayim shamoa tishmu. I'm contrasting the two parshas. Schar V'Onesh in this world is by the Tzibur, not by the Yochid. Partly because in this world we live as a Tzibur. If something happens to me, it affects my wife and my parents and my children and my friends. And so we're all connected to each other. The next world, the Olam HaNeshamos, is really where we can be isolated and dealt with as individuals. Schar of Onish is in this world is on a national level. The Torahs are all written nationally. It doesn't say if you'll do good things, you'll win an Academy Award. It doesn't say that. It says it'll reign, and militarily you'll be successful, and the economy will be successful. It's about the bigger picture of a nation, which is, by the way, Jakey, why the questions of Acher, etc., came up only then. What? The 2,000 years... 1,000 years, 1,500 years between Har Sinai and Acher, they didn't ask the question. They never saw people suffer. As long as Am Yisrael was in their land as a people, people could believe that the Schar V'Onesh was national. Now suddenly, the nation is disintegrated, right? So how do we understand Schar V'Onesh? And then it becomes a very sharp question. And that's when Chazal started talking about Olam Haba. It always existed. We always believed in it, but they had to start talking about it when Olam Hazeh couldn't give you the Schar V'Onesh. You got more than you asked for. Yes, Mr. Katz.
This one is from Adam Berman. It's a three-part question.
Shmuel Steinman's got a haircut. Okay, very nice. He has ears. Yes.
Oh,
three-part question. And he has red cheeks. Shmuel Steinman's is pretty red before he blushes. Now it's tomato. Grinta, give him your shirt. Yes, okay.
What's the purpose of Galut? Are we still in it? If so, it's a four-part question. What can we do to bring Mashiach if there is anything to do?
What's the purpose of Galus? Interesting question, no?
Yeah.
The Torah says what the purpose of Galus is. Well, you see, the Torah says why and when Galus happens. What does the Torah say about why and when Galus happens? Why does it happen? You're sinners. Exactly what sin leads to what gullus, we could talk about. And definitely the land is a big part of it, but if you sin, the punishment is you get sent to gullus. That's what the Torah says, right? Now, what for? The question was why and what for?
Well, the gullus is spoken before we sin.
I'm sorry?
I mean, first name of Asarim, we're told they were going to go to Asarim before we sin.
Mm-hmm. Most of the Bishonim say that Avram did something wrong that caused that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same assumption. But forgetting what happened with the gullus Mitzrayim, which we could talk about, the Torah talks about gullus coming as an onish. What for implies that there's a purpose, not just as an onesh. And there definitely have been commentaries who spoke about the gullus not just being a punishment, but being a rehabilitative punishment, a chance to learn, to grow. For example, the Torah already says it. The Torah says you'll be in gullus, you'll be beaten down, and you'll become humble. And you'll have vidui for your sins. So definitely it talks about the gullus being not just a punishment, but a way to rehabilitate you. And many talk about it being a chance to influence the world, maybe learn from the world. Again, those things aren't discussed clearly in the Torah, but there are definitely commentaries to speak about it. Rav Kook has a number of interesting pieces where he talks about the need to bring back things from Gullus in a purer form, for example. So that's Gullus. Gullus is a lot easier to understand than Geula. Because the second question was, are we still in Gullus? Are we still in Gullus? When I grew up as a kid, it was Pasha to me we're still in Gullus. Right? I think in Chutzlar it's at least a traditional / more Haredi community. We're still in Gullus, at least when I grew up. I don't know if it's changed today. But we're in Gullus. Even people in Eretz Yisrael don't use those terms so much, but they talk about when the Gula comes. I don't mean you, I'm saying, right? We're in a very situation that's hard to define because Jews always assumed that the Geula would work a certain way. And on the other hand, they assumed we wouldn't go back to Eretz Yisrael until there would be the Geula. Now we have a problem because we're back in Eretz Yisrael, ruling ourselves, but it didn't happen the way it was supposed to happen. That's where the confusion comes from. So personally, I believe in the religious Zionist view. That's what I believe. That it's impossible to explain what's going on as not being a fulfillment on some level of the things that Kodesh Baruch Hu spoke about in the Torah. Again, people know the sources for this. I don't have to go through them again. Now, the question is, okay, so it must be something. What exactly is it? There it becomes very unclear. And I think, you know, there are semantical issues, but one thing is for sure. I don't think there's a single religious person who believes that we have completed the process and we're where we need to be. So, are we in Gullus? Are we in Geula? Is it Reishis Tzmichas? Shetei Reishis Tzmichas? Tzmichas Reishis? You know what I'm saying? Reishis Yerushalayim? You know, tennis courts and good dormitories, you know what I'm saying? Meaning, exactly what you call it is less important than, on the one hand, I believe what's happening is significant. On the other hand, clearly there's a way to go. So now the last question becomes, what do we need to do? The answer is, believe in the Rebbe. And salvation. No, Zach, isn't that true? The Rebbe, by the way, maybe the greatest Jew who lived in the 20th century. Definitely, no one was greater than him. Could be people who were equal to him. Soloveitchik was a great, great man. Chazon Ish was a great, great man. And many others, but the Rebbe, the depth of his Torah, his personality, each one of these, his Torah itself would make him, you know, no one greater than him. His Torah itself is tremendous. Not just what he said in Chassidus. And his impact, and I'm saying, he definitely had the Jew who had the most positive impact in the 20th century. Can anyone debate that? Well, maybe one could say Ben-Gurion. Depends on what kind of impact you mean. But definitely, religiously, the Rebbe had the greatest religious impact in the 20th century. We can say that, right? That's not how we bring the Gula, though. I think we look at the Torah. The Torah says we bring the Gula by living properly. Now, the question is part of living properly, building and developing Eretz Yisrael? Absolutely. Is that the only thing that's important? Absolutely not, right? We have to, A, do the right things, and B, try to get other people to do the right things. I don't know if people have other tricks, you know. You say God's name backwards 63 and a half times, sitting on a red cow on top of a black cat on the ashes looking at our Zayson. Maybe. I don't know. I've never tried that. But Brand afterwards will be leading the procession. That's what the Torah says. Okay, you got it on them, Zen?
One more question.
Morty? Okay, yes?
So, Masechet Shabbos and Masechet Avodah Zarah have these like really weird cures for different diseases. How should we look at those?
I guess cures? I brought that up myself, right? Look, there's a big question that's discussed about Chazal. Obviously, we believe in Chazal. We believe in Chazal. We believe in the Torah. We believe in the Mesorah. 100%. Question is, do we believe that they were the best doctors? Or do we believe that their cures are part of the Mesorah? Those are two different questions, by the way. Or their psychological advice. Or their, you know, or even if they were totally accurate in their own time, are they still accurate today? That's a good way of respecting Chazal, but, you know, writing them off at the same time. not that I do, I'm saying I think they're people who have a struggle. That's the way they formulate it. Look, I don't think a part of our Mesorah is believing that Chazal had the best understanding of medicine. They understood medicine based upon the kelim that were available to them. And people say, it says about the Torah, foch ba the kula ba. So if you learn Torah very well, you learn everything, right? So does that mean that the best way to become a surgeon is to study the Torah? The Rambam didn't believe that. So the answer is that once you learn it, if you look deeply enough in the Torah, you can find everything there. It could be once you learn it and know what you're looking for. And once you know Freudian psychology, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong, you can find a lot in the Torah. Does that mean you would arrive at Freudian psychology through the Torah? Again, I'm not getting into whether it's right or wrong. Same way, you know, people come and explain the first parak of Bereishis based on the Big Bang Theory or whatever else. Does that mean that anyone ever got to it using the first parak of Bereishis? So again, that's why we study other things, and that's why, you know, we do value Chochmah v'goyim tamin, right? The goyim have Chochmah, not Torah. Torah is direction for life. Chochmah is wisdom itself. There's a lot of wisdom out there. We study the wisdom. And does that really mean? The Gemara, in fact, says that the Chachmei, the Torah, and the Chachmei, you know, Goyim had a debate about something astronomical, astrological. And the Gemara says that the Chachmei, HaGoyim were right. The Gemara says about themselves. So, does it get any better than that, Adi? It doesn't get any better than that. Masya!
That's similar. How do we then take what Chazal say about social things,
yes.
In terms of how community today will decide to redefine Kavod Tzibor by saying not that it's for not to have woman aliyah, but to give them a place.
Or, for example, Chazal based a number of halachas on the phrase Tav Lemesav Tandu Mi Lemesav Armalu. A woman prefers to be married than to be alone. Right? And so, what if that's not true today? Someone wants to ask Rav Soloveitchik whether the halachos rooted in Tav Lemesav Tandu should be changed based on the changing of the reality about that. I don't remember the exact quote, but he said something along the lines of Tav Lemesav Tandu is an ontological, existential, objective, non-dependent statement about the reality of women, and meaning what Rav Soloveitchik said. It's understandable why the question was asked to Rav Soloveitchik and not to Rav Aaron Kotler. Right? What he was saying was there's a difference between when Chazal are making a statement about something sociological, about the reality, not rooting halacha in it, versus a situation where they're building halacha on it. They're going to build halacha off something which, because halacha is eternal, this is supposed to be eternal. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean that every single thing that halacha is built off is eternal. Meaning there are definitely realities that halacha builds off of, that when the reality changes, the halacha changes because it's built off a reality. But when halacha takes into account a psychological statement about interrelationships, that's a very different type of thing. Now, by the way, how do we know which is which? That's why we have great gedolim. That's why we have great gedolim. The problem is when people who are not such great gedolim think that they can be the ones to determine how to draw those lines. And we have to obviously be very, very careful. Right, he's been waiting for a while, Jess. Should we give him a chance, Brandon? Yes, Mr. Shimmy.
The last Q&A that we had, you mentioned in a side comment that feminism is a factor in bringing the gula. Can you please explain the theory?
Feminism is a factor in bringing the gula.
Where it is bringing
That's why I'm being quoted.
You said it's a sign of
the gula. It's a sign of the gula. Okay, right. I think that might be a little bit more accurate. Okay. I didn't mean you were trying to, you know, these things have a life of their own, you know what I'm saying? You know, I wonder if so many people showed up for this question and answer session. With quotes like that, you know, right? Brandon Lurie's bringing the gula. So the answer should have been, when Alex Katz asked, how do we bring the gula? The answer should have been, feminism. It's simple. Yeah. The question really begins with the fact that the Torah says, v'hu yimshal bach. The Torah says that man is supposed to rule over women. And that is traditionally what marriage was, both in religious and non-religious circles. The difference was that religious people quoted a pasuk as the basis for it. Today, I don't think very many religious people believe that the ideal marriage is v'hu yimshal bach, and the question is, what about that pasuk? So I think what many people answer, what I believe the answer is, and I don't believe it's the answer, I believe it's the truth. There's a difference between an answer and the truth. Is that there are many other things on that list of klalos that aren't ideal, but they're punishments. For example, Torah says as a punishment, you'll sweat to work. Right? Most people who work today don't sweat. And they might say their jobs are hard, but they're not as hard as they used to be. The same way, it says that a woman gives birth in pain. Is it a chiv for a woman to have pain? Is it usher for her to take an epidural? When I spoke in that time, when I spoke about it, that in English, you know, in Christian England, in the 19th century, many Christian leaders thought it was usher for a woman to have to use chloroform, because it says, it's a tel dibanim. No Jewish posek has ever suggested that, because we've always understood that it's a klala. It's a klala that you're going to suffer in childbirth. It's a klala b'zeh sapechot ha'olechem. It's a klala v'huyim shalbach. And it's interesting to note that all of those klalot are slowly softening as the Jewish people are returning to Israel. Is that coincidental? If we connect to the question before. The gula is the Jews return to Israel. The gula of man is that the klalot that came after the eating from the Eitz Hadad are going to be reversed, right? And they're all moving. So one could see feminism as a sign of, and part of what needs to develop properly, again, anytime there's a change in reality, change comes with difficulty, right? So feminism is going to an extreme, right? Most people, not just religious people, feel feminism is going to an extreme. And the point is to come back to a happy medium. Interesting thing it says about Mitzrayim. One of the things the Egyptians did to the Jews was they had the men do women's job and the women do men's jobs. What's interesting is they did some kind of thing in England where they had the wives and husbands reverse their jobs for X amount of time. It seems the wives did a better job at the men's jobs than the men did at the wives' jobs. That's where the result was. The men were at home taking care of things at home, and they messed up the whole home. The women had to work even harder. First working during the day, then coming home and fixing everything the husband's messed up. Okay, make sure you marry a good woman. Make sure you treat her like a princess. What movie was that? Denzel Washington. He's taking care of his son. He needs a heart transplant, so he takes hostages. No?
Q.
John Q. So he says to his son, the son is sick. You're not into girls, yeah, right? One day you will be. Make sure you treat her like a princess. Good vart. No, Shimmy, what do you say? Yeah. I've been watching inspirational speeches lately. So one of them I saw was Rocky VI. It seems like it's very popular on the internet. I didn't know it went that high. Life's going to beat you down. You got to know how to beat it back. Okay, yes. Morty Dubin is here.
You mentioned part of this before. Is there a goal of finishing Shas or knowing Shas?
Is there a goal of finishing? What does it mean if you don't know it? What does finishing mean?
That
you turn the pages?
Yeah.
How do you get credit? How do you get credit for learning the page? If you turned it. Turned it? Oh, I don't know. You have to go like this. So you know, and turn the page. How long does it take? It's 3 hours? Come on, how long does it take to finish Shas? It's 2,700 pages. How long is it going to take? Okay, I have to do both sides. 2 days. So of course, it's about a healthy balance. So what you don't mean is finishing versus knowing. You mean knowing absolutely perfectly, neurotically and OCD, or, you know, knowing it on a basic level. So it's all a matter of balance, right? And we have to learn some things very well. It's important to do that too. We also want to get exposure to the bigger picture, right? So it's balanced. Ultimately, that depends a lot on who you are as a person, right? Different people are going to appeal to different things, right? You asked. Did you ask? You asked, right?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't ask. Okay, Brent. I remember that. I had engaged you. I didn't know if you had actually asked. Yes?
The Ramban on Vayechi says that when Yaakov was giving the brachos to their friend Menashe, that Yosef switched the hands because he was afraid that the bracha would be messed up because...
What's your question?
My question is, well, basically, how do brachos work? Because by Yaakov and Esav, we didn't find
You know, we don't know the answer because the Torah doesn't give us a brachos handbook, meaning... Shackle, baby Adam, I'm saying this kind of thing. What?
Feldheim does.
Not these kind of brachas. Now, there are definitely a lot of suggestions and ideas put forward by the Rishonim and obviously the Kabbalists, what a bracha is, what a bracha isn't, right? And of course, part of the question you're asking is what's the relationship between physically what's happening and what you intend, right? What you're thinking about. So, on the one hand, we don't know. On the other hand, we do have a little bit of sources about brachas, right? We see that fathers give brachas to their children, and we see that Kohanim give brachas to Jews, right? And what does it say about the Kohanim? It's samu et shmi al bnei Yisrael v'ani avarachem, which means we define things in a certain way, and then God, if we've defined ourselves, each other properly, God relates to us based on that, right? So a bracha is expressing a wish, setting a goal, and obviously gedolim, you know, who set that goal and that wish, it obviously means more, right? Because of who they are. Now, exactly how it works and, you know, the magic of the hands and which hand is where and whether the significance of switching the hands was somehow, you know, metaphysically or what it meant to Menashe and Ephraim and psychologically, right? You'll find both those interpretations. And the real answer is we don't absolutely know, right? Meaning, Kohanim blessing the people, is it because metaphysically puts the name of God on the people and then God blesses them? Is it psychologically that people see themselves and identify the name of God? Those are basically the two approaches.
So what's the dichotomy between that and Yaakov and Esav when Yitzchak thought he was giving the bracha Yaakov?
Same brother. Question you have to ask there. And there are even others who suggest that it didn't make a difference that Yaakov came in because ultimately it depends on what Yitzchak really intends. And then in the end when he says, Gam Baruch Yiyah, he's giving his consent to it. And that's what changes it, right? You'll find all the interpretations based on different people's approaches about the balance between the metaphysical and the psychological. For example, Ayin Hara. How does Ayin Hara work? What are the two basic approaches? There's a metaphysical approach, magic, right? And then there's a psychological approach. Somebody looks at you weird and say you get all spooked out, right? So you'll find those interpretations in general when it comes to these kind of things, right? Yeah, Brandon Lurie's here. Are you making tea for us? For later.
If you want later, let me know.
What kind of tea is it? You hold a bag like that, you figure it's a specialty.
It smells good.
Okay. You should know, in my day, tea bags were straight. Now they have these like 3D triangular tea bags.
Now,
what?
Now it just be PG tips.
PG tips, that's what they're called?
Right.
Are they called PG tips? So, what people are going to say officially is, you know why they have 3D bags? Because it increases the surface area. You understand how it increases the surface area? Unofficially, it's just because we have to do things better, different, and weirder than the generations before us. We can't just use a regular tea bag. We're going to have something better, different. I don't mean branded, I'm just saying, you know. It's interesting. One day they'll have cubicle tea bags. So look at us, we have cubes. Use a regular tea bag, it works. Yes, Brandon with the right. Magical tea bag.
In the same vein as kind of what you said, how does Torah, things you have in the Torah, that like are explicitly contrary to
like contemporary social trends, how do we like reconcile those? Yeah. Like for example, women's rights or slavery or things like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think slavery is an excellent way we can deal with the issue. So let's take that as an example. Our society believes that slavery is abhorrent. Terrible. Lincoln, right? New movie. Lincoln. Terrible. Slavery is terrible. Judaism disagrees. Who's right?
Us.
Judaism is definitely right. By the way, you could ask 98% of people who lived in the history of man. They would agree with Judaism. The writers of the Constitution agreed with Judaism. So, some of them, none of them, at least as far as I know, none of them felt it should be abolished and needed to be in the Bill of Rights. And maybe one of them, I don't know, they wrote somewhere else. Meaning most of them had slaves. Meaning, again, you could say, in principle, they had slaves. Right? So you don't have a philosophy, right? Yeah, they had slaves, so what's pshat? The answer is, what do we tell ourselves? How does the average American answer the steer between they're being absolutely convinced of what's right and wrong, and our forefathers. There So there's this thing about Thomas Jefferson, to whatever extent it's true or not, that when he died, he released his slaves. But that makes him a tzaddik? I understand. Meaning, if you believe that slavery is abhorrent, so when he died, he released his slaves, that redeems up his, you know, we can accept Thomas Jefferson as a, you know, as a holy Jew. What's pshat? Kriegel, what's the answer? Meaning, people lived up to 1860 throughout the world. People who lived up to 1860 in the world were immoral.
They were moral for that time.
What does that mean?
How you treat them?
Immoral is essentially subjective.
Most people today would not say that slavery depends on how you treat them. Most people today would say that slavery is abhorrent. Period. So what'd you say?
I said that morality committee is subjective among the convention.
What's pshat? Meaning, are you saying that there was a time where slavery was moral, or there was a time when people saw it moral?
A time when slavery was
moral.
It's
objectively, not just they saw it moral, it was correct. So, what does that mean? That's our problem. Our problem is whatever our society believes today, we assume is always true. Let me give you an example. You want to hear an example, Brendan? Is it moral to eat ice cream or meat when we could be investing our resources and making sure that there aren't children starving in Africa? Is it moral to buy a car when you can give that $20,000 to save a child in Africa? How many of you have ever been in a car? How many of you are immoral? Keep your hands up. No? Is that immoral? I want to tell you what's going to happen. Someday in the very near future, they're going to devise a pill or something of the like that gives people the nutrition they need to survive. It's going to become very cheap to keep people alive. And there won't be starvation anymore in this world. And that time, I don't know if it'd be in the life of your life, your children's lives, your grandchildren's life, your children and grandchildren will look back at you and talk about how immoral you were. Morality has a lot to do with what can be done in our world. The reason slavery was always seen as moral is because if you want to have cities, that means you're going to have fewer people farming for more people, and you're going to need slaves. Until you get machines. Is it coincidental that the abolishment of slavery is parallel to the Industrial Revolution? But no one wants to see ourselves as, you know, the morality that we can foster. We've arrived at the truth. Rav Kook, many people know, was stuck in England during World War I. And he saw the sweatshops in, you know, East London. And people know, you know, he had them in America. He had them in all these Western countries that had an influx of Eastern immigrants, Eastern European immigrants. And he said, what's better, the sweatshops of capitalism or the slavery of the Torah? What he said was, there's always going to be people at the top of the ladder who are going to have people at the bottom working for them. The question is anyone going to care about those people at the bottom to take care of them? And that's what Gavi said a few minutes ago. So I'm just using it as an example. We have to realize the Torah allows for slavery because it is the right thing in many times. The Torah's not taking a position on it. It allows for it and makes sure that things are done properly. How could it not abolish it? Isn't it absolutely wrong? It's not absolutely wrong. There are times where it's necessary. Better, right? You got the idea? Yes.
What about the case of women's rights, which wouldn't necessarily fall
women's rights.
Category?
Women's rights. Women have rights. Don't they have rights? Right. What rights don't they have? Give me one example.
Then they have today. No,
but what rights do women not have? That you're talking about the Torah. What right does a woman not have in the Torah?
Ability to be.
Oh, you said right. Being a shlitz is not a right. The right to divorce her husband. Okay, no, that is an example of a right. It's not a right, it's a power. But he has rights. The reason I don't have to talk about that particular example, but the reason I stopped you is because the mistake that our society makes in relation to religion is thinking that it's about rights. Religion is not about rights. Religion is about responsibilities. Now again, if you take the corrupt values of the 20th century, 21st century, and try to corrupt religion with them, so you can definitely do that. It's not about rights, it's about responsibilities. That's where we need to get started. Now we can talk about a different question. How should, marriage and divorce work? It's not just divorce, by the way, that's the issue. It's not just divorce that's the issue, but that's the question you asked about. Meaning there are three options. There are three options of how marriage and divorce can work. I'm not saying it would work, but I'm saying of how it could function. One is where both men and women can marry whoever they want. Meaning, a woman can have three husbands, a husband can have three wives. The second option is that no one can have more than one. And the third option is that a woman can have, there's four options, I guess, right? Everyone, no one, or one versus the other. Now, if we're talking about rights, so rights, it should be absolutely equal. Like today, right? Today it's absolutely equal. People don't have the right to have two husbands or two wives. Where that went, it comes from we know better morality. But why? Let's start with this here. Why does the Torah not permit a woman to have three husbands? Anyone? We're speculating, but we'll speculate. The Torah doesn't say. Yeah.
Why wouldn't they accomplish anything?
Why wouldn't it accomplish anything?
So she could only have children from one of them.
Why couldn't she have children from all three?
Not at the time.
One after the other. It may seem illogical to us. The answer is that children won't know who their fathers are. A child will always know who his mother is. Wouldn't necessarily know who his father is. And if the father doesn't know who his child is, and the child doesn't know who his father is, I don't want to make any cultural references in our own societies, but that's not a very healthy way of having a family, correct? Okay. You got me, Sam? Okay. Now the question becomes, why does the Torah permit a husband to have three wives? Why does the Torah permit a husband to have three wives? Well, we ask a broader question. Why did society permit men to have many wives throughout most of its existence in most places? What? It's easier to populate. I would say even sharper. It was absolutely necessary in the sense that many women died in childbirth. Most women died at some point in childbirth. Many women died early on in childbirth. And beyond just the childbirth question, just maintaining the work it took to maintain a family, it worked a lot easier when you had a group working together. Now again, we can look back today from our high pedestal of the 21st century and judge everyone who ever lived before us as stupid without knowing the reality of what the many societies were. That it's not coincidental that the post-Gim prohibited more than one wife at the same time when that was happening in Europe as a whole because of societal changes that were taking place. Not that halacha changes. What's the right thing to do changes. Divorce. So Catholics, for example, officially, depending on who you are, right? But officially don't allow for divorce. We can understand that, right? Best way to build a stable family is to not allow for divorce, right? And understand the evil of it on the other side, right? Not the evil of it. You understand the problem with that. To lock people in. Even to lock people in, not necessarily because they're going to want to get divorced, but for people to feel they have no choice, it puts a lot of pressure on. So we believe that there should be divorce. That having been said, we don't believe in making divorce an easy option. Why don't we believe in making it an easy option? Because people would get divorced very easily. Exhibit A.
For right?
Sorry?
How do we make it an easier...
We try to discourage it as much as possible. We build a society around... I don't mean we stop people. We do try to discourage also. The halacha is, if you're a rabbi, someone comes to you and says, I want to get divorced, your responsibility is to try and convince them not to. Now, again, obviously, if the husband's beating the wife's beating the husband, you know, yeah, let's not convince them to stay together. You know what?
He's explaining the Gemara at the end of Bava Metzia. That, and yeah. Where it says that a man can divorce his wife from grounds of things like...
First of all, it's not Bava Metzia, it's in Gittin. Second of all, the question is how we understand the Gemara. Yeah, okay. You know, possibly that way also. Anyway. look, the best way of seeing the problem with divorce being something people choose like they choose lemonade is to look at our society today, which is a totally fractured world. I remember, and I'm sure it's worse today, there was a show that I'm sure none of you ever seen because it's a woman show called Judging Amy. Anyone ever see it?
Oh, yeah. I actually have seen that.
Judging Amy is a powerful show because, and I don't know if people in American society, Western society, who are so steeped within their own problems can even appreciate what it's saying. The woman is a judge. She's a judge in family court that deals with custody issues, etc. And every case is about the dysfunctionality of the family and the kids and the parents. And basically, summarize it this way. If a parent doesn't realize that from the moment when they have a child, their central responsibility in life is raising that child. If a parent doesn't realize that, children are going to be dealt with improperly. And divorce is a major part of that nafkamina. The fact that I had a child and brought you into the world doesn't make me responsible to make this marriage work. If the marriage doesn't work anymore for me, you'll just have to understand that. The irony is that Amy is divorced. The judge! With kids going through major issues. And she's the judge. Again, the way the show goes on is that, you know, her own struggles and seeing what goes on in court and how she reflects it. You know, it's a great premise. The Musa Haskell is, you're all freaking screwed up. You know what I mean? And look what you're doing. Look what you're doing to your families and your kids. And look what's happening in society. You know, the message of Parshas Ki Tetzé is that the problems in society begin with failed marriages. Now, ultimately... The issue of divorce begins with how Jewish marriage begins in the first place. Divorce is an afkamina of marriage. A man is not committed to his wife. I mean, he has financial responsibilities and personal responsibilities, but I mean, he's not committed to his wife in the sense that... Can you? That he can marry another person. The man can marry another person. He's not making a sole commitment to his wife. Now, why? We explained a few minutes ago. As soon as you begin with that premise, the rest falls in line. Why is it that a woman, Kiddushin is a woman committing to a man? Again, there are commitments in the man to the woman too in Kiddushin, by the way, but very different types. It's because the woman can't marry anyone else. When the Mishnah says, Isha Nikna Zabala, look at all the Pirushim, and they say that she can't marry anyone else. Divorce is the man letting the woman off that commitment. Now again, our society doesn't believe in commitments, it only believes in rights. I have the right to do whatever the hell I want. I have the right to do whatever I want, even though I already made commitments. It doesn't matter. I have no commitments to anyone. I do whatever I want today. Tomorrow I change it. The next day I don't change it. So everything's... Nothing makes sense to us. It really all begins with that. By the way, what is the basis of the belief that men and women have a different role? Meaning, the idea that a woman has a special role with a family. Where does that come from? Chazal? What? What part of biology?
Reproductive system.
Women give birth. Women carry babies in their stomachs for 9 months. They give birth and are supposed to nurse the children. And that creates a certain relationship. Now, we can try society-wise to change that, but that's where it comes from. Right? People didn't like the answer to the last question. I'm not insulting. No problem. Not like it. Yes, Ezra Cohen.
On that theme, female witnesses.
Female witnesses, yeah.
The lack of, I guess.
The lack of female witnesses. Look, you know, it really starts here. You guys are asking me a lot of questions, the answers to which are speculative. Torah doesn't say, right? Torah doesn't say females can't be witnesses because... The Torah doesn't say slavery is good because... The Torah doesn't say a man divorces his wife because... We do our best to speculate. The speculation that's generally said about female witnesses is... there's different kinds of speculation, is... the role that women are supposed to play in society as a whole, the function of moving the court system, not moving the court system, because it's not just witnesses. Women's been able to have judges. I'm saying, you know, it's part of a much bigger whole. So you could come and say, well, it has something particular to do with witnesses, and women weren't reliable, they are reliable, they're not reliable, right? You could focus on witnesses, but that doesn't answer the bigger part of the question. Clearly, Judith, this goes back to Masi's question from before, clearly halacha is built off certain assumptions about the roles that different people are going to play. Now the question is that still correct? Now we assume it's pashat that wrong. There's no way is that correct. That's not correct, right? Well, we're living an experiment of changing the roles that men and women are supposed to play in society, and I don't think you have to believe in the Torah to believe that thus far the experiment is not succeeding. When I say not succeeding, I don't mean that Ezra Cohen's parents are wonderful people. They're wonderful people. I know them personally. If it was just how Ezra Cohen's parents are doing, then it's a wonderful success. But I'm talking about across the bounds of society. And that's really the question. Many of us are influenced by what we see in society around us, and we should take a step back and realize that what we see is not very good. I'm not talking about it's not good for a woman to be a judge. I'm not saying it's not good for a woman to be a doctor. I'm saying the package of the changes that have happened, how they've affected our society. You can say, what do you mean? There's far more less spousal abuse today than there was 100 years ago. First, I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure that's true, but the question is, what's really important? I don't mean to imply that spousal abuse is not an important issue. But clearly, the most important issue is that society builds itself properly. Now, a lot of people would say, what do you mean? Society's doing wonderfully. People have freedoms. They do whatever they want. I guess it depends what your goal is. If your goal is that people grow up with values, with a sense of responsibility, healthy, cared for. Meaning, it's true that people didn't have semi-automatic weapons 100 years ago, but they had hatchets. How many people went out and murdered 50 people? Now, you know, there was Jack the Ripper, there was this guy, there was that guy. But today, every week. And I don't think it's just because how many guns you have available. You can kill a lot of people with a lot of weapons. Our society is unhealthy. And that's what I mean. What Republicans will tell you is, you know, we shouldn't restrict people. We should make sure to educate them properly and blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is, we're not. Now, again, Republicans believe in their values. If everyone was like us and Marianne and Sammy Joe and everybody would have our values, it could be. Could be. You know, we have to go back to Footloose and fix the movie and, you know what I'm saying, and everything would be happily ever after. Could be. But the bottom line is it's not happening, right? So before we take the values that our society has proven to be holy and correct, we should really be careful. Yes.
So earlier you said that halacha doesn't change, but the right thing does.
That's halacha doesn't change, right? But certain realities change that halacha relates to. You understand what I'm saying?
That there's a morality outside of God.
Morality outside of God or outside of halacha? Outside of God. God created everything. What's outside of God? Every thought comes from God. Every part of
what Hashem commands us.
Ah, meaning are there moral notions? Well, the answer is yes and no. I mean, you know, thousands of pages have been written on this, but the answer is yes and no. And again, the exact balance, you know, is debated and etc. and semantics and how you classify and da da da. But the answer is yes and no. The Torah itself commands people to be holy, good, straight. It uses these broader terms, right? Vasita yasher v'atov v'ene Hashem, for example. So you see that the Torah speaks about things that are good and straight that it's not specifying. So clearly there are things that are right and moral that we arrive at on our own. Now how exactly do we know and how exactly do we mandate and how do we draw the line? Those are excellent questions. So I said yes and no because yes, there are things not specified in the Torah that are more moral and important. B, they're not outside the Torah because the Torah itself already commands about them. Right? Now obviously, the Torah can't mandate every right thing in all possible circumstances. If an old woman is crossing the street, there's another portion of the Torah, help her cross the street. If you're 20 meters away and she's 46 and a half, if you're 10 meters away and she's 72 and a half, if she's carrying one bag, if she's carrying two bags, you know what I'm saying? You have to have a sense of goodness, right? Is it a chiv to run 2 miles to help a 55-year-old woman cross the street with her dog? I would say no. Is it a chiv to run 2 miles to save someone's life? Right. Yeah, of course. So now we have to know. No problem. Oh, Leo raps. Fuel the fire. Who gets fuel the fire? Who wants to get fuel the fire?
Me.
I get it already. Lehman, what are you calling your Dvar Torah?
I don't know. You're a good name.
How about Red Benj? Read Red the Dvar Torah. No? Red Dvar Torah. If we get a name, then I'm sure Benji would send one out, right? Okay, all we're missing is the name. Who wants to have a contest? Naming Benji Lehman's weekly Dvar Torah. Ariel, got any good ideas? If you did, you could use it to name your Dvar Torah. Oh. Oh, you see that? That's very nice of him. How about he'll be fueled the fire? Oh, actually, you would be fueled the fire. He would be the fire. Ah, the fire. You fueled the fire. Okay, yes.
What should one do if they're either sitting in a shir or talking to one of their rebbe and they start repeating Lashon Hara?
Them or their rebbe?
The rebbe.
The rebbe starts telling Lashon Hara?
Or you're giving a shir, yeah?
Because I'm fired.
Rebbes are human? They make mistakes?
Yep.
No. Yaakov, is it true? Is it possible? You're asking a much broader question, I assume. You see someone good doing something wrong. Someone respectable, etc. You don't want to show them disrespect. What do you do, right? You're a sensitive. By the way, can I have a much broader question? You see a regular Jew doing a sin. Do you tell him tocha, not tocha, right? There's a mitzvah of tocha, but the Gemara says we don't know how to give tocha today, right? So that doesn't, you know, you have to be very careful. So you want to be sensitive, and you have to look at the atmosphere and know the right time to say the right thing, right? I definitely wouldn't stand up and say, you know, Rebbe, you're saying Lashon Hara, you're evil. There are different ways to skin a chicken. I'm more than happy if I ever do something wrong. People should come tell me, you should know I think you did something wrong. I do things that are wrong. Try not to. You know? People always ask me, when, you know, great Gadol does something wrong, you know, what do you say about this? Or what does it prove? Or what do you say? I say, it proves he was human. He is human. In case you, you know, didn't know. Human beings? They make mistakes. Even Ezra Cohen makes mistakes, no?
Every now and then.
Okay, yeah.
Is it better to say it's in a shir? Is it better to like stay in and just say, you know?
Assuming you can tolerate it, you know, maybe you want to close your ear. It shouldn't burn your ear, like the Gemara says, right? I don't think it's a joke, because I think I sounded funny. I thought I was saying it's a joke. Meaning, Lashon Hara should burn our ear. It should hurt us to hear something like that being said. Curse words should hurt our ear. It hurts me to hear curse. It hurts me. It should hurt us. If it doesn't hurt us, there's something wrong with us. Now, it could be it was important to say you don't realize you'll clarify after that. Okay, fine. Maybe the Rebbe was right. I don't know. Maybe he was wrong. I personally invite anyone I did something wrong, please come tell me. I don't think you have to put up a sign. You don't have to say announce the whole base medrash. You don't tell me right now. You know, you don't want to do that. Okay, you know, I won't get angry, but you know, you don't have to. Yes?
So, a few minutes ago, you spoke about you said that on a national level, like, it does work
in this world, but... Torah says that. I mean... Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then I went downstairs and I started Daf Yomi, and it says that someone who does Oneg Shabbos, he will get a... Nachla b'li mitzarim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kol l'maneh, kol l'maneh, Shalos, yes.
And, like, their mothers would say, like, there are examples where...
Very specific things. Yeah. All the examples are discussed. Take a look in the Pirushim. I know when you learn Daf Yomi, it's us to look in the Pirushim because the goal is to finish, right? Not to know it. But look, all of them are discussed. You want me? I can tell you what the Mefarshim say in each of the cases if you want. You have two options. One option is to say it means some other world and some other thing. Or, you know, it's a special skula. It gives you more of a chance. You know, the two rutsim. The other is to, you know, try and philosophize it. Deeper level, broader idea. Right? Yes?
Is it
b'di'evet
to eat meat?
Is it b'di'evet to eat meat? Well, the Torah definitely mandates eating meat sometimes. So I don't think you can say, you know, that it's wrong to eat meat. Although... You know, the claim that meat is b'di'eved is the fact that it was only made mutter for man after the mabul. And the question, like we were talking about before, to what extent are the things that were made mutter at a later stage an indication of something less ideal that we hope to reverse back to an earlier, better world? And I'm sure you know Rav Kook has a famous piece where he talks about vegetarianism as being some higher ideal. And again, meaning, I think there are two questions. One, is the fact that, is it a higher ideal that the world is meant to return to? That's question number one. Not at all clear. Although, fair to say it. Second of all, if that's a higher ideal the world is meant to return to, does that mean we should be trying to make that change? Like, we should be trying to have healthier relationships between men and women. We should be making women suffer less, right? The question is, should we be trying to return that back? And of course, the difficulty in answering the question is we don't have the tools to answer the question. You understand what I mean? We don't have the tools? Meaning, I can quote you, this Rebbe says this, and this Rishon says this, and this is not. So it's very speculative. I think mainstream Judaism does not see eating meat as a problem. In fact, sees it as a kiyum of mitzvos, the number that we do. I don't think, in Onik Shabbos, I don't think that it's wrong to say what you said. I think it is not generally accepted and not the mainstream Jewish belief. Okay, Masya.
A few machlokes
from Rashi Tosfos.
So one of them is that Tosfos holds that the listener is as if he's actually saying, as if he is.
What's your question? I'm familiar.
So according to Rashi, if you're davening Shmoneh Esrei and you hear that they're starting Kedusha, because mm-hmm. you're only somehow you're being yotzei to the words, but not the actions themselves, should you jump up and down three times for Kedush, Kedush, Kedush?
I don't think it hurts your Shemoneh Esrei to do Kadosh, 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 and Mil Shemoneh Esrei, so go for it.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay, yes.
If something is...
Gino Belinik, you think maybe Avi Berman is a little bit... what's the term I'm looking for? In your face.
Just a bit.
Just a bit, yeah. I was like, excuse me? Okay, yes. But thank you for handling it, right. Okay. Yes.
Something
like in the Yisera Sedibros and the Shavu Sosfot Nidav, is something that's exclusive to one, like Irem Menachai, is that more important than something that's exclusive to
Yisera Sedibros? You want to know if a mitzvah that the whole
world has a chiv to keep is more important than what's in the
Yisera
Sedibros?
There are some like Avodah Zarah.
It's in both. So you want to know Avodah Zarah, what do you want to know about it?
Not Avodah Zarah, it's in both.
So what do you want to know? You want to know if every Menachai is more important than?
Than not being a false.
Than something in the Aseret, only in the Aseret HaDibros. Yeah. Meaning, what shows more importance? Being in the Shev Mitzvei Noach or being in the Aseret HaDibros? That's the question, right?
Yeah.
The question is a very hard question to answer because what criteria do we use for rating mitzvos and their importance? And the Mishnah talks about this, right? Don't, mitzvah kala, mitzvah mitzvah. You don't really know. So what criteria should we use? The onesh, very often spoken about, the severity of it. I think the severity, the sechar and onesh, may be the only criteria we can really look at. In which case, although, take for example, testifying falsely. The Gemara says some pretty scary things about that, right? The fact that the world shakes, does that mean it's Mohammed? Gemara talks about it within that. So we look at the psukim, we look how things are described, we look at the onesh. But like the Mishnah says in Avos, our job isn't to rate mitzvahs. We should try and do them all. Especially if a person realizes that the significance of doing mitzvahs is showing your commitment to the will of God. Then everything you do is the same and everything you don't do is the same, right? Okay, let's go back to Seder. No? Mordechai, Seder? Later.